This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Adventures in the Orgasmatron, a lecture and discussion with Cabinet editor Christopher Turner, held in celebration of the publication of his book of the same title. It took place on June 28, 2011.
And tonight's curiosity is Chris Turner's book, Adventures in the Orgasmatron. My name is Paul Eli, and I edited the book with Farah Strauss and Giroux. And it's an extraordinary book. A different book I edited was reviewed last week in The New Yorker, which said, this odd, fascinating book. And seeing that, I thought, wow, that could apply to all the books that I'm involved with. And I'm proud to say that it applies to Chris's book, this odd, fascinating book. Really, he's found a missing piece of the puzzle that is the puzzle of modern times. It's harder and harder to find a strange story or one that truly hasn't been told or one that resists easy interpretation, but Chris, with the story of Wilhelm Reich and the Orgasmatron, has found it. It's a story that, oddly enough, begins with Freud and ends with Lee Rinaldo, Sonic Youth. And how I wound up in email negotiations with Lee Rinaldo of Sonic Youth for the photos that he took of William Burroughs' Orgasmatron, that's a story that Chris can round out. But what it suggests is that this is a story that goes beyond boundaries and mixes together things that we don't expect to find in one place. Adventures in the Orgasmatron, Christopher Turner. Come on up, Chris.
Thanks, Paul, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I first came across Wilhelm Reich 15 years ago when I went. I was a university undergraduate, and I went to Summerhill School in Suffolk, England, to do some backyard anthropology. It was a school where the kids made up their own rules, and they voted on absolutely everything, including whether I could stay in the wigwam on the school grounds, which kind of appealed to me as an anthropologist. But unfortunately, I had to stand and watch them all vote through a glass door, and very few arms went up. They all wanted to keep the wigwam for their smoking. So this school was founded in the 1920s, a kind of like proto-anarchist school, because sometimes the kids voted to scrap all rules. But the headmaster who founded the school, A.S. Neal, met Wilhelm Reich in the 30s and went into analysis with him. Wilhelm Reich had been a psychoanalyst. He'd been one of Freud's second generation of pupils. But the psychoanalytic movement had ejected him for his communism, and the Communist Party had ejected him for his because he was a psychoanalyst. You know, they didn't like a philosophy that concentrated on the individual over the collective. So A.S. Neal went to Norway for 2 years for therapy with Reich, and we're going to see a film clip soon in which you'll see what kind of therapy Reich innovated after he left the psychoanalytic movement. His wife described it as having dispensed with the psychoanalytic taboo of never touching a patient and substituting it with a physical attack by the therapist. And you'll see it really is quite a vigorous and energetic process. Neil described Reich as having the claws of a hawk. And I submitted to Reichian therapy with two different analysts. One literally made me scream. It was so painful. He would dig his nails into my jaw. Apparently I have a stiff jaw, and that was my main problem. So He would just be working away on the jaw, and I'd be screaming and kicking. And then I went to this other analyst, Alexander Lowen, and he actually appears in the clip. So when you see the therapist in the clip, that's Alexander Lowen. And I went to see him because he's one of Reich's last surviving pupils. There were two still alive then. And Loewen actually died in 2008, but he was 97. I went to his house in New Canaan, Connecticut, and he sort of said, come on, let's go to work. And he led me through his study into his treatment room. And I was like, no, I've just come to ask you a few questions about Reich. But his assistant was like putting a sheet on the couch. And he said, right, get undressed, we're going to go to work. And within 2 minutes of meeting him, he had me doing forward rolls in my underpants on his analyst's couch. And, you know, 50 or 60 forward rolls, you know, he was like, don't throw yourself so hard, you're going to kill yourself. But he just kept me going and going. And you'll see that in this clip, the patient, you know, I'd seen this film already, and the patient is basically having a simulated orgasm on the couch. So I was quite worried by the idea of treatment with Alexander Loewen. But I started shaking because of the exercise. I wasn't used to the exercise. And he was like, yes, vibration. Vibration is life. And he was really pleased with me. It was quite satisfying. So the orgone box, Reich invented the orgone box in 1939, and it's an odd device. And we have an example tonight, which was built especially for this evening by a professor at Pratt. And we're very grateful to him for going to so much effort. Murphy is his name. And I know that a few of you have tested it already. But Reich invented this box. He thought that it could concentrate the orgone that was in the atmosphere. And this orgone was a kind of libido that was free-floated in the atmosphere. And he thought that somehow this orgone energy, as he called it, could penetrate the wood. It was absorbed by the wood and somehow concentrated in the metal interior. And you sat inside it, and the orgone energy in your own body would kind of interact with the heightened orgone. And he called this orgonotic lumination. And he said that, you know, that was akin to the sexual act or the infant on the breast. And, you know, he described orgone energy as sexual energy. You know, Reich thought that the orgasm was the thing that made the difference between sickness and health. You know, a satisfactory orgasm would mean that you wouldn't, you know, get neurosis, that cancers wouldn't congeal. You know, the orgasm was the answer to every health problem. So in the late 40s and 50s, the orgone box became a fad. You know, Norman Mailer had one. I interviewed him about his orgone box. He built one with a carpet-lined interior so he could scream his lungs out. And he also built another one in the shape of an egg, which he could roll around in the grass in. But by the time I met him, he was a bit more cynical. He said, you know, frankly, the orgone box is kind of crap. You know, it's a bit like the atomic shelters people built in their cellars. You know, you're kind of embarrassed about it 10 years later. And he was certainly embarrassed about his time in the orgone box. But, you know, Salinger, Saul Bellow, Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, who claimed to have had a spontaneous orgasm in his box, the box he built. You know, they all sat in this box hoping for sexual enlightenment. And it interested me, you know, as a kind of device to tell a story of the sexual revolution. You know, why would people seek to shed their oppressions by climbing into a closet? You know, those of you that have been in it will see how claustrophobic it is. It really is like a tight, alienated space. You know, one person in there, in the heat, in the dark. Hello. How was it for you? So I thought you could unpack the history of the read the history of the sexual revolution against the grain by looking at this box. You know, what does it tell us about the ironies of the sexual revolution that the symbol of liberation is this, a box? And in the 60s, Time magazine ran a story in which they claimed that, you know, perhaps Dr. Reich was a prophet because the whole of America has become one big orgone box. You know, everywhere in popular culture and in, you know, magazines and music is the message that, you know, sex will free you and libido set you free. And, you know, so the box became a kind of symbol not only of, you know, the sexual revolution, not only of these utopian hopes people had, but also of, you know, how sex became commercial. And I thought that was interesting, you know, trajectory to trace through this device. So, you know, now we're going to screen a few clips. The first one is from W.R. Mysteries of the Organism, which is from 1971 by a Yugoslavian director. And you'll see Alexander Lowen in this, so look out for him. And you'll also hear Reich's voice, and you can see how charismatic he was. He managed to persuade Einstein to test this device for 2 weeks. Einstein spent 2 weeks of his precious time in his basement in Mercer Street, Princeton, testing a box, which is, testament to Reich's powers of charisma. So you'll hear Reich's voice, and then we're going to show a clip from Woody Allen's Sleeper. Obviously you'll see the... Sorry? No, why don't we have the Q&A after the clips? It's like 10 minutes of clips. Can we last 10 minutes? And so the next one's from Sleeper, and you'll see that Woody Allen, in satirizing the orgone box, has kind of made it a little bit more sophisticated. It's electric, it's got lights. It looks a bit like one of the loos on Virgin Atlantic. And then we'll also watch a clip from Barbarella, in which you'll see someone who's clearly based on Reich trying to kill Jane Fonda with pleasure. And in this first clip as well, A.S. Neal's the one with his shirt off, so you can see that they had, A.S. Neal. All right, thank you.
In the 1950s, the Organon became an international center for sex economy research. Rumor called it a secret Jewish organization that was masturbating patients in orgone accumulators, experimenting on children kept in cages, and plotting to introduce work democracy. Federal agents, eager to observe sex scenes, lurked in the bushes with their binoculars. Reich shot at them.
I took my gun. And I saw a group marching and clearly shouting, "Commies, commies, commies, come out with you. Orgy, 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 orgy." And I stopped them right away. And I asked them, "Who has called here, down with the commies or out with the commies?" And I saw then Anderson, the druggist. I elected Eisenhower today. I'm for Eisenhower. Everybody here did. Now, that does not help Eisenhower. It does not help America. I'm going to report it to the FBI. I want to say nobody here is a communist. We are all fighting the communists. But I have fought the communists long before anybody in the United States knew the communists in 1930.
Are men from outer space already living on the planet Earth? On March 10th, 1956, at 10 o'clock at night, this almost incredible idea came to me. Am I really a spaceman? Do I belong to a new race of Earthlings sired by beings from outer space who had intercourse with Earth women? Are my children the first offspring of an interplanetary race? Is this thought in some way related to what is yet to happen in the future? I claim the privilege of asking these and similar questions without fear of being imprisoned for it by any authority whatsoever. I hate the irrational. However, I believe that even the most flagrant irrationality must contain something of rational truth. There is nothing in this human world of ours that is not in some way right, however distorted it may be. In the 1950s, the Organon became an international center for sex economy research.
And once the breathing begins to deepen, then the feeling begins to flow through the body. And we will promote this also by mobilizing the movement of the pelvis. Now, bounce it up and down a bit. Come on, bounce it. Come on, rock it. Come on. Come on, keep it rocking. And keep breathing. Very good. Keep it rocking. And while she's breathing, I listen to the sound of her breathing. Oh, good. Keep it going. Very good. That's it. And you can hear the air being sucked into the body spontaneously. Ah. Now come up a bit. Bring your head up. Bring your head up. Now press on your feet. There's a lot of holding in most people at the back of the neck where their stubbornness and their spite is located. And it's a holding against giving in, letting go to their feelings, letting their feelings take over. Very good. Very good. Now let the crying come in. He would ask me to breathe, first of all, breathe. Your eyes are going off. Look at me. Look at him. Your mouth, you're hurling your smile. Let it go. Let it go. And also pressing the chest down and sobbing in a very short time. And really feeling these, and then even in the sobbing, don't stop breathing, because everybody cries. I mean, it would be nothing to get somebody to cry. You get any sadist could get you to cry. But to cry and to feel the person pressing forward. Keep the breathing. Don't stop the breathing. Let it come through fully with a full sob. Let it come. Don't stop. Don't. No, you're running away. You're running away. Don't run. Don't run. Let it come. Let it come. Keep breathing. You're forcing the breathing. Let it come naturally. Now you get desperate. You get mad as hell at him. Keep it. That's it. Get angry, but don't stop breathing. And finally, go through the body and to feel this, what he would call my urgency, give way, and I would feel it give way to this kind of peaceful streaming in the body when the breathing came through fully, and to feel this current of energy leading to a very warm, strong sensation, particularly in the genitals. And it's not the same as just becoming excited sexually, though it was related to that, but it was a feeling of fullness and pleasure and not empty feeling that you're just living in your head.
No! No!
Where's the head?
No! No! No!
The movement is caught about at this level, and by breathing in and out, the tortuous S movement of the body, you know, it's trying to establish itself. Breathe out, breathe out. Sigh, go ahead, as you breathe out. That's it, go ahead, sigh. Keep the chest lower. Enough for this movement. Enough for this movement. Put the knees up. Get a hold of it. That's right. Breathe. That's right. Let the whole body go into it.
That's the way.
That's it. That's it. That's it. Let it. Rest down on the heels. That's it. Sigh, sigh, go ahead, sigh. Loosen the jaw. That's it. How do you feel?
I feel very bright and much younger and more alive.
You want to push the car, please?
Great, great.
Thanks for two.
Blue eyes. One on either side, of course. I like the arrangement. That's why I married her.
See, you are. You're teasing me again.
No.
Yes. You think I'm stupid.
No. How can you say that? I think that you're bright and sensitive and...
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, yeah. Well, then how come you're not attracted to me? You know, I mean, men go crazy over for me. I'm great physically. I got a PhD in oral sex.
Yeah, did it make you take any Spanish with that?
What?
Well, I don't know. I was an English major myself. You know, Chaucer, Pope. I minored in foreplay. It's a 2-credit course at NYU.
Miles, you're not taking me seriously.
What do you want me to say when you say, do you want to perform sex with me? You know, it's so cold. I need to be warmed up and send flowers, romance, you know.
Sex is different today. You see? We don't have any problems. Everybody's frigid.
Oh, that's incredible. You know, the other men impotent?
Yeah, most of them, except for the ones whose ancestors are Italian.
All right, I knew there was something in that pasta.
You want to get in the machine now?
No, you know, we don't need that. You know, really,
I think it'd be great if we did, Miles. I wouldn't be frigid.
You wouldn't be frigid with me. Believe me, nobody ever is. I got the magic fingers. Yeah. You're going to be, you know, I swear, I've cured more women of frigidity. That's my specialty. I'm 2 minutes in bed with me, and you'll sell that thing for scrap iron. Really, I got a lot of fast moves. Really, I swear. The only thing is, I have a little asthma, so if you hear some wheezing while we're doing it, you know, it's me. But, you know, just give me a decent burial and...
This is the police. We have the police
around. Come out with me. Here's what I want you to do. Hide in this room. I'm going to lead them away. Find your way to the Western District. Contact the underground. And find out what the Ares Project is. Will you remember that name?
Yes, the Jupiter Project.
The Ares Project.
The Ares Project. Yeah. But what about you?
Don't worry about me, honey. I'm like a cat. I'll always wind up on my feet. My dear. Sonata for executioner and various young women.
Oh, it's sort of nice, isn't it?
Yes, it is nice in the beginning. Wait until the tune changes. You may change your tune as well.
Oh, goodness. What do you mean?
When we reach the crescendo, you will die. Pleasure. The rain will be swift, but sweet. Very sweet.
Girl, what have you done to my scissors machine? You've undone it! You've undone me! Look! The energy cables are shrinking! You've turned them into faggots! You! You've burnt out the excessive machine. You've blown all its fuses.
My goodness.
You've exhausted its power. It couldn't keep up with you. It's incredible. What kind of girl are you? Have you no shame?
Oh.
Shame. Shame on you. You'll pay for this.
Hello, good evening. Is this on? My name's Tom. I'm actually a serious student of Reich for 25 years. I have extensive experience with his work. I have direct experience with a good 95% of it. And just to counter you, I will speak to the authenticity of it. I encourage you all, including you, to actually read Reich's works. Workshops are held all over the place where you can actually experience and observe, you know, the scientific stuff.
No, I have read Reich's work.
I'll ask you more specifically exactly what you've read, because you're making a farce out of really serious, amazing work. I mean,
you read my book?
No, I haven't, but I've read...
Well, there you go, I'm one up on you then.
I've heard you speak so far. I've seen you use this stuff as a representation of Reich, which is actually a representation of the very thing Reich was critical of. So you're making associations that don't belong, and whatever I can to dissociate them.
What I'm interested in is how Reich spreads out into the popular culture. You know, I'm not interested in.
And this is an example of it.
Yeah, no, it is an example of it. But this is real. This is history. This is what happens. You know, I'm not interested in looking at it, you know, just as a kind of religious practice. You know, I'm interested in looking at it as a historical event, as something that, you know, had an influence wider than just, you know, Reichian practice. It spread out into the culture, how it influenced Sorbello, Salinger, Norman Mailer, all these people. You know, I'm interested in how it spread into the culture at large.
But one of the fundamental things about Reich's work is, one of the things he discovered is the distinction between health and illness, what he called primary drives and secondary drives. And you're completely blending that line with the associations and the way you're connecting information here. I mean, I just offer that for, you know, I don't want to dominate here, but you're taking very serious and extraordinary work. It is life-changing. I mean, I know the stuff everybody's seeing here, parts of it, you know, move you deeply, and parts of it you want to laugh at. Some of it you want to laugh at because it moves you deeply. Some of it you want to laugh at because it's put into a mocking context. And you're doing that. You're perpetuating the very thing that Reich was critical of. He's not responsible for the sickness. He helped clarify it. The orgone accumulator, it's not an orgasmatron. It's a box, but it's a serious and amazing scientific evidence.
Do you use one?
I have a lot of experience with it. Right.
And what effect does it have on you? It'd be interesting for people to hear.
I'll tell you two. One on me personally, directly, and secondly on experiments. If just to rule out the whole thing of placebo or the mysticism around the box, you put seeds, you do seed sprouting experiments, seeds will grow a half again as big in an accumulator as in a control. You know, that's not something you invent, that's something you can test physically, scientifically, and get repeated results. That I've done, that I have experience with. Sitting in it, I was surprised even in here, because usually this is like an atmosphere you wouldn't want to use it in, because it's kind of toxic, kind of heavy, kind of, you know, a lot of moisture, and it actually didn't feel as bad. It had a little bit of a harsher kick than what they usually do. They usually have a softer sensation, but there's extraordinary health benefits. I never had any serious illnesses, so for me it just, you know, just feels good. You know, it feels supportive. But it's a real device. There's real science with it. You know, there's metal and there's organic matter. There's physical properties that are associated with that. It's very easy to look at it and make fun of it. It's an amazing thing. It's a real device. Take the time, you know, to research it. Okay. I don't believe that you have seriously researched it.
All right, well, thank you. A real live Reichian.
Yeah,
you should talk to him later.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Read Reich's books, you know, to counter this orgasmatron.
Okay, that's enough from you.
Didn't he first invent the box to cure cancer?
He invented the box and claimed it could cure cancer, and that's one thing that certainly...
He never claimed
to cure cancer. No, you've got to stop, because I've actually been to the archive and looked through the archive, which is more than you have, I'm sure. Okay, you've got a date to look through the archive, but you haven't.
Yes. Okay.
If you read my book, you can see a quote in which he claims that it could cure cancer. He says it would definitely cure cancer. I know he changed that because the FDA prosecuted him for promoting a fraudulent cancer cure. He backtracked on that, but he certainly did after he invented it, claimed it could cure.
Hello.
Hi.
In the early 1960s, somebody said, I got a book that'll change your life. It was Function of the Orgasm. But what really affected me was character analysis, and I became a psychotherapist and started doing couples therapy before there was any. And the important thing is if you go on the internet and you type in coital alignment, coital meaning intercourse, there's a new understanding of positioning and the coordination of movement. It is consistent with the idea of a bioelectric buildup, very definitely connected between the man and woman, with both equally active. And it went from studies that say 25% of women reach orgasm from intercourse to 77%, almost always or often. And that's a major breakthrough, and I don't think I would have been motivated if I hadn't read Reich. Thank you.
Okay.
Hey, I'm really interested in what this is all about, and I don't really feel like I've gotten anything yet. I don't feel like I've gotten any opinions or perspectives from you, just really a presentation of, hey, there's this thing that happened,
and
there's these cultural perspectives that went on, and I'm interested, and I know you wrote a whole book.
Yeah, but please read it.
Yeah, so I'm
you know,
curious.
This is just a taste.
I'm curious
taste.
If you have, if you can... drill it down to just a clear thematic, like what's your thesis or what's your argument in the book itself?
What I'm looking at in the book is how I'm trying to look at the sexual revolution in a new way, looking at the history of the sexual revolution. I think Reich laid the intellectual foundations for the sexual revolution. He might not have agreed with what it became. He certainly didn't agree with what it became, but he came up with the phrase the sexual revolution. You know, people, his ideas spread out into the culture in interesting ways. He had a very small group of followers. He had a little group of disciples who concentrated around him in Maine. But, you know, that was only, you know, that was nothing compared to how his ideas spread out into the culture at large. I was interested in how in a post-war culture in which people's ideology was questioned. You know, the people who'd been communists no longer wanted to be communists because of the Hitler-Stalin pact. You know, they didn't want to be allied with fascism. And they were looking for a new ideology, and they found that in Reich. And they took from Reich what they wanted. You know, they were quite eclectic in what they took from Reich. You know, they didn't swallow it wholesale. You know, they took it in creative and interesting ways. And that's what interested me in writing this book, in tracing this book, how you can look at for a cultural history through science.
First of all, congratulations. I'm so excited to read the book, which
Thank
I
you.
Just purchased over there in the corner. I've read a lot of the work, actually, and I've been up to Organon, I've been to Rangeley and all of this, and it's an amazing trip. And what's always sort of mystified me about Wilhelm Reich, which I've written about a little bit, right, is the appeal. I was wondering if you had any sort of insight, having written the book, which I haven't read yet, into his charisma, into his appeal. I mean, Freud, at a moment in Freud's career, Freud really truly cared about him. Yeah. And he was really a very young and sort of precocious and important part of the psychoanalytic world, and he was such an important force in Vienna and Berlin, and later on at Rangeley in Maine, where he had his laboratory and all this, he still sort of attracted people. And I was wondering if you have any sort of insight into that attraction.
No, well, the first half of the book is split into two sections. One is Europe, looking at what Reich's life was like in Europe. And he was incredibly charismatic, and he was the leader of the second generation of analysts. And he did push for psychoanalysis to become political in ways that it hadn't been so far. He wanted psychoanalysis to kind of treat the masses, not just individuals. He didn't want it to be a kind of bourgeois therapy. And he took analysis out into the streets with psychoanalytic vans and stuff where, you know, they would go and sort of set up in town squares and there would be a gynecologist there and he would give speeches about, you know, how sexual repression was, you know, was bad. And they would distribute condoms and things like that. And he also set up this free clinic in Vienna where everybody could come and have free treatment or they could pay what they wanted for free treatment. And because of this, he also ran a technical seminar in where he sort of called for new experiments in psychoanalytic technique. And he was really the leader of that. And he actually, with character analysis, promoted a new technique, which was he wanted to shortcut the slow process of analysis. You know, analysis took years. It was interminable. He wanted it to be fast. And, you know, with character analysis, he was interested in kind of confronting the patient in ways that, you know, psychoanalysts wasn't used to. And I think all those innovations, you know, they really made him the leader of the second generation. There was a group of people who all corresponded in a secret letters, you know, this kind of political wing of the psychoanalytic movement. And he really was the sort of ink that bound them together. And in when he came to America, you know, he'd had a terrible time in Europe. He'd been, you know, thrown out of Berlin, thrown out of Scandinavia, you know, thrown out of Sweden, thrown out of Denmark. He'd been really persecuted and hounded as fascism spread across the continent. And he came to America and hoping for a new start. And it was very sad that he didn't get the new start that he hoped for. He, you know, immediately he got here, you know, after war broke out, he was interned, you know, through a terrible mistake because someone who shared the same name as him and William Reich, and taught at a school down the road, he was confused with him. So he was thought of as a communist, even though he'd renounced communism and promoted this new theory of work democracy at that time. But really in America, there was an article, the first article, you know, about him in the popular press was called The New Cult of Sex and Anarchy, and you saw a segment from it up there. And Reich, even though he didn't know this avant-garde, you know, he disapproved of the avant-garde. And any avant-garde, you know, Paul Goodman sought him out, and Reich said, "Look, please don't promote my theories as anarchist. You know, I'm, you know, that's not me. I'm forward." He said. But anyway, he was removed from the people that took him up, and that's what's interesting to me. You know, he's not the people that took him up weren't devotees. He had a very small group of disciples. They were all doctors, and they followed him up to Maine. But they were a very small, close-knit group. But the influence I was interested in, the thing I was interested in pursuing, was that wider, you know, cultural sphere of how he kind of his ideas spread like fire through the West Coast and the East Coast.
And does it feel significant to have published with FSG, which for so many years published his books?
No.
A planted question, but it's actually not.
No, well, FSG kept Reich's ideas alive, really. You know, his books wouldn't be in print. When he published his books, they were all self-published. You know, his first book was published by a press, but everything else was, you know, self-published. You know, character analysis, the mass psychology of fascism, were all published by his own presses. So, really, Roger Strauss was so appalled that Reich's books were burnt by the FDA, you know, when they prosecuted him for promoting a fraudulent cancer cure, this box, and they spent 7 years investigating it, and they prosecuted him. They wanted all the machines destroyed that he was renting out and selling. They burnt 6 tons of his books in a New York incinerator, and Roger Strauss was so appalled by that, you know, so horrified that, you know, America in the late 50s would sort of, in, you know, have book burnings. You know, Reich's books were burnt in Nazi Germany, and here they were in the late 50s in the Cold War being burnt in, you know, in New York. So he made a vow that as long as he lived, Reich's books would stay in print. And he's no longer alive, so I'm not sure whether that vow is in jeopardy. But certainly his books have been in print all this time. People wouldn't really be able to read them otherwise.
Hi. I've done a little bit of research on Reich's harnessing of organ energy to do what he called cloud busting, and I wonder if this had any impact on the wire culture, such as you proclaim as sexual theories did, and if you touch on it at all in the book.
Well, I touch on the cloud busting, but I think, you know, whereas the orgone box did become a fad in New York, you know, people, you know, bohemians and beatniks did use the box, you know, and one of Reich's disciples said, you know, that the bohemians and the beatniks were the first people to take it up, and they did use it as a device to masturbate in. You know, this is one of Reich's disciples saying this. With the cloud buster, you know, it's a very complicated thing, and, you know, nobody really took it up. I did meet someone who used to spend every day with a cloud buster device on the East River trying to clear the air over Manhattan. It was Tom Mangravite, who, he was one of Reich's followers until Reich was very paranoid, and he thought there were communist spies everywhere. And Tom Mangravito, after the FDA investigated him, was cast as a communist spy, even though he was a sort of faithful devotee at the time. So he had a very complicated relationship to Reich's legacy. But he also, Reich used to use these cloud-busting machines not only to try and influence the weather or fight UFOs. You know, you heard in the clip that, you know, he speculated whether he was the son of a spaceman towards the end of his life, which, you know, I found an indication that he was psychotic. You might disagree with me, but certainly his prison psychiatrist said that he was psychotic, and I think that's a clear indication of psychosis. This machine, which was, you know, it's a kind of armor. You know, Reich was interested in busting armor in his therapy, and I think this machine is a kind of armor. You know, it's a symbol of persecution, really. And I think that, you know, that's true in Reich's life. But with the cloud buster, this machine was kind of turned inside out, so it was projecting all its goodness into the cosmos itself.
Yeah. Okay. I came here looking for a kind of a closure or a revisiting. During the 1970s, I was in Reichian therapy for 5 or 6 years, and I agreed with both of you. It was both good and insane. I had an orgone blanket. The orgone devices could take various shapes and forms. I hated it. I felt it was nonsense, and I threw it in the trash. The therapy was a big thing in my life for those 5 or 6 years, and it seemed so very real, and it seemed so so valuable and admirable, and I also knew all of the criticisms, and I also experienced many cultural things. I don't know, in the context of who is in this room here, the Woody Allen's satire on the orgone box, the Orgasmatron, it did not take much building on the part of the set builders, because it is a standard darkroom door. And during the 70s, I taught photographic darkroom technique at Cooper Union, and we had the identical door, and I would go through the door alone and with many other people, and everyone, of course, was aware that in a spectacular film, the same darkroom door played the role of the Orgasmatron, and I had a lot of fun in the darkroom door.
Did you sit in the box as an adjunct to therapy?
I never sat in an actual box. I did it today, and did not get any particular feel. my therapist at the time, I'm going to name
her. Who was your therapist? Sorry.
My therapist was Muriel Dunn. And from time to time, she has passed away. I have tried to Google her. And there is no, there were so many intelligent people who took therapy with her that I fully expected that there would be former patients, if not here tonight, to have a reunion with, certainly who had posted in their, somewhere on the internet, but somehow Muriel is nowhere on the internet. And this was a woman with very, almost no formal education, who had come up, who had been privately trained, would not name who trained her in Reichian therapy, was actually, seemed very confident, seemed to be good at it, found a way to make, she was a single mother who found a way to make quite a lot of money, an astounding amount of money, I suspect, from
this. How much
were
you paying? How much were you paying a session?
Well, you have to understand inflation. I paid $50 an hour.
Wow.
But $50 in 1970 dollars is, I think, 200, 250 in today's dollars. So. I put quite a lot into it. It was a. I'll tell you another thing. It was a time, although drugs were never discussed at that at the therapy. It was the same period of my life when I started smoking a lot of pot. And it was the 1970s. And in the 1970s, for those who were not adults during that time, people smoked a lot of pot, and people had sex very quickly. It was not like today. AIDS did not exist. And you met somebody you liked, and boom, you were there. I feel in the end
that...
That
sounds
that,
fantastic.
That, well... I think I'm a happier person today, and I've heard truth coming from, shall we say, both sides of the room, and a little off track words coming from both sides of the room.
My book has been on the bibliography of the emotional plague for years from these Reichians, before anybody's read it, and it's like. It's a serious book, and I wish they would read it before they, sort of cast stones, because I certainly treated Reich's ideas with respect and read them. So thank you very much.